And 33.1% is the annualized increase in the gross national product for the third quarter of 2020. It is a historic increase, but the significance of it is being hotly debated in Washington today. And tied in with economic growth is the ongoing debate on a new coronavirus aid package. We'll be discussing these issues as well as getting a campaign update 4 days before the election. Good evening, and thanks for joining us on Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Peter Slynn. We'll begin with the economic numbers. The 33.1% annualized increase in the GDP from July through September time period follows a 31% plunge in the second quarter. President Trump touted the economic activity several times in a campaign speech in Florida, and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi also discussed the economy in a letter to the Trump administration today. She wrote, quote, "As the coronavirus surges and the stock market plummets, we are still awaiting the Trump administration's promised responses on multiple items of critical importance. Your responses are critical for our negotiations to continue." And she later spoke about it, about the coronavirus aid package, at a news conference.
I just recently, this morning, sent a letter to Secretary Mnuchin spelling out some of the concerns we are still waiting to hear back from the administration. In good faith, I believe both sides have gone to the table to discuss the priorities. 2 weeks ago, the secretary said that he was willing to accept our testing language. He just wanted to make a light touch on the language. 2 weeks ago, the light touch was 55% of the language, largely eliminating our initiatives that addressed the disparities of the virus when it came to minority communities in our country. More people in minority community, I am told, have died of the virus than those not in the minority community. I've said it before, if you're a black child, you have 5 times more chance of going to the hospital for COVID than if you're a white child. If you're Hispanic, 8 times more chance. It's sinful. It's sinful that we have not addressed protecting the lives of the American people on the path that this president has taken, starting with calling it a hoax, saying it's going to magically disappear. The list goes on. And even though in all of our legislation we have talked about testing as being a key to stopping the spread of the virus. So the letter is self-explanatory. It talks about state and local government. What is it? This statement that was even in the Wall Street Journal that said that local state and locals face the biggest cash crisis. State and local governments face the biggest cash crisis since the Great Depression. And yet, the president mocks and says this is unnecessary for us to do.
And that was House Speaker Nancy Pelosi at her weekly briefing on Capitol Hill. Well, the Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, responded this afternoon to the speaker's letter, tweeting that her all-or-nothing approach is hurting Americans. Now, during the question-and-answer portion of her news conference, one reporter asked the speaker about today's Commerce Report on the GDP growth.
Madam Speaker, the economy grew at an annual rate of 33.1% in the third quarter. Does President Trump deserve any credit for that?
The CARES Act deserves credit for that. We had lost ground in the second quarter. This barely makes up for that. And the CARES Act deserves credit for injecting the resources into the economy, whether it's then in our subsequent CARES and the subsequent PPP. So it's as if somebody used an example this morning, as if you lost $100 in the second quarter, and now you're making up $65. Glory, hallelujah. No. And if we don't pass a recovery bill, a COVID-19 bill, that we will face dire circumstances as well. So, yes, Congress and the administration worked together in a bipartisan way to pass the CARES Act as well as subsequent legislation to inject resources into the economy. The lack of doing that this time is going to take us back down to another path.
Again, that was Speaker Pelosi earlier today. Now, on the coronavirus aid negotiations, White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow is putting the blame on the speaker.
The PPP had $135 billion unspent. It would have been so easy to have congressional appropriations to repurpose those monies into a new cycle. I just never understood that. We can debate the ideological and political differences. We can relitigate that. We have an election for that. But in terms of economic assistance to help the very group you just mentioned, the unemployed, which I agree with you is way too high, and we must deal with that. While the economy is recovering, we need to help them. And we should have had a deal. We should have had either standalone bills or something, Bob. We should have had a deal to help them and the small businesses that are most vulnerable, and hence the workers in the small business. And I just think it's a mystery why we could not have reached a compromise agreement. You know, today, I mean, Secretary Mnuchin calls me up at 7:30 this morning. Speaker Pelosi sends a letter, like we need a letter. He talks to her every day for the last 3 or 4 months. And that this letter mysteriously is published in the Politico before the secretary himself even gets a copy of it. I mean, that to us said, okay.
Why doesn't President Trump call up Speaker Pelosi? Why doesn't President Trump just pick up the phone and call Speaker Pelosi himself?
Because Secretary Mnuchin is a terrific negotiator, and that process was working, but unfortunately it didn't reach the outcome. All the issues on the table, but it became all or nothing. And again, with this morning's the business about the letter and so forth, Secretary is so frustrated on the phone, and we just think she's stringing us along. I'm sorry to say that, it's not personal, but I don't think she wants a deal or a compromise pre-election. So we'll wait perhaps till post-election.
Now, in the same interview with the Washington Post national political reporter Robert Costa, Mr. Kudlow discussed the GDP numbers.
You got a 33% increase, annualized increase in the third quarter. That's a record. And I want to go underneath the hood here because I think this is a self-sustaining recovery. The numbers are gargantuan. I'm just going to read them off. You have consumer spending up 41%, housing up 59%, business investment in equipment up 70%, and automobile production up almost 1,200%. So my take, Robert, is this. This is self-sustaining. It's going to spill over into the current quarter and into next year, policies permitting. But the one missing link, and a lot of people have not talked about this, you're going to get a big inventory rebuild. Now, I don't mean to go into the grass and weeds on business economics, but that's the way the economy works. You have rising demands liberated by the reopening of the economy. And now the inventories have to be rebuilt in order to meet those demands. That means you're going to have several quarters, maybe a good year, of more production, more manufacturing, more construction, more jobs, more wage increases.
So, Ben Castleman of the New York Times, how should we read these GDP numbers?
You know, I think that this is a tricky one. You've got to recognize that we saw a record-setting rebound in the third quarter, but that's a record-setting rebound from an even more record-setting drop in the second quarter. We sort of turned off the economy in the spring. We turned it back on at least partway, and we've seen some real improvement since then, but it's not enough to get us all the way back, and we're seeing signs of slowing progress, which is concerning.
And unemployment is still relatively high?
Unemployment is still high, though certainly lower than it was at the worst of it. Incomes are still down. Output is still down. So we're healing, but we have not healed.
So, Ben Castleman, when you see this 33% number, where are the increases happening?
Well, so I think one thing that we should make sure we understand right off the bat is 33% is an annualized figure. That means that it's the rate if it were to continue it for a full year. But we actually only saw a 7.4% gain in Q3 relative to Q2. So that's just sort of an important thing to keep in mind. The big gains were in consumer spending, which is the driver of the U.S. economy, but particularly spending on goods, on stuff. We've all been able to sort of keep buying things during this pandemic. What we haven't been spending much on is services. We haven't been going out to eat as much. We haven't been traveling as much. And so we've kind of got this bifurcation in the economy where one side is doing pretty well. People are buying cars. They're buying stuff for their homes. But they're not spending money on experiences the way they normally do. And that's holding back a big chunk of the economy.
So is this leading to a fundamental change in our national economy?
It certainly is in the short term. What, of course, is very hard to tell at this point is how many of those things are durable and last once the pandemic, hopefully soon, is behind us. You know, I think most of us think that, you know, people are probably going to order online a little bit more than they did. You know, we've learned to order things on apps that maybe we weren't used to doing, and so some of that will stick around. Maybe some of us will work from home more after this is all over because now we're set up to do so. But there's a lot of stuff that inevitably is going to come back. I don't think anybody thinks that restaurants are dead forever, that bars are dead forever, that air travel is dead forever. What we just don't know is how much of that is going to reset and how long it's going to take for us to get back to normal.
Mr. Castleman, when you see the GDP numbers, what's been the effect of previous federal government aid plans dealing with the coronavirus, if any?
Yeah, I mean, it's very clear that the big aid packages that were passed in Congress in the spring had a really big impact in a couple of ways. For individual households, And for individual businesses, they went a long way towards mitigating some of the impact. Unemployed workers were getting an extra $600 a week in unemployment benefits. That made it much easier to go ahead and pay rent, to buy groceries, to be able to stay home and not work. It also had a big impact in lifting the overall economy because people were able to keep spending and not pull back the way they normally might when they're out of work. That kept money flowing through the economy. The trouble is, of course, that aid has now mostly dried up. We haven't seen Congress able to reach a deal for a new aid package. And so as a result, that has sort of leaked out of the economy long before the economy has fully recovered.
Has the Federal Reserve played a role in this GDP number?
Yeah, the Federal Reserve certainly has played a very important role. They played it a hugely important role in the early stages of this pandemic. It's sort of easy to forget now, but in the beginning here, we saw a lot of turmoil in financial markets, and the Fed kind of stepped in to try to shore that up, to try to ensure that credit markets were flowing so that big businesses could continue to get access to credit. We've also seen them bring interest rates back down to zero, which we saw today in the GDP number. The housing market has held up amazingly well. It's booming in a lot of the country. And that is clearly, at least in part, a direct result of interest rates being low. The difficulty is that there are certain things the Fed can't do. It's not going to sort of solve the fundamental problems of businesses that are insolvent, that can't function right now. Those are things that really have to be done through Congress, not through the Fed.
Ben Castleman, the president often says that the stock market equals jobs. It's at about 26,000 right now. The high of all time was at about 30,000. How do you interpret the stock market? Is it artificially high?
I mean, I think the important thing to remember is that the stock market is not the economy. That's true in a number of different ways. Only about half of Americans own stock in any form. And so a lot of people are not benefiting from that strength in the economy, in the stock market. The stock market is also global. A lot of the biggest companies that are heavily represented in the stock market have sales around the world. And so it's not an accurate representation of what's happening in the U.S. economy. And it's fundamentally forward-looking. So it's not telling us necessarily what's happening in the economy right now. It's telling us what investors think is going to happen in the economy down the road. And so that's why we saw a big drop and then a rebound in the stock market, even as the sort of fundamentals of the economy, unemployment, income, those things have not rebounded nearly as quickly.
So when you look at Europe and some of the predictions for Europe, they're rather dismal compared to the U.S., correct?
Europe has taken a very different approach to handling the virus, and that has had a different effect in their economies. We're going to see numbers, GDP numbers out of Europe tomorrow. I think many of them may show a smaller rebound than we've seen in the U.S., at least in some countries. But I think the real test of this is going to be down the road. You know, pretty much every country had to shut down their economy to one degree or another. Pretty much every country has opened it up to one degree or another. There are going to be some differences there. But the big question is, how long does it take economies to kind of get back to fully humming? And I just don't think we know yet kind of which set of approaches necessarily worked out better.
And what about Asia? How's it doing?
I mean, a lot. Asia has by and large seen a significantly stronger rebound. They did a better job of controlling the virus than either the United States or Europe did. And as a result, if you look at countries like Korea and Japan, as well as China, they seem to have weathered this storm better. I mean, it's a lesson here that ultimately what's driving the economy right now is the state of the virus. And if we can't bring the pandemic under control, it's going to be very difficult to get the economy humming again.
Well, Ben Castleman, we'll look forward to seeing the GDP numbers from Europe tomorrow. Ben Castleman with the New York Times, nytimes.com. And the Dow, NASDAQ, and S&P averages all gained modestly today on the strength of the GDP numbers, but have not recovered from this week's losses. While the Labor Department reports that the number of Americans seeking unemployment benefits fell last week to 751,000, the lowest since March, but still historically high. Claims fell in 30 states, including California, Florida, and Texas. Claims went up Arizona, Illinois, and Michigan. Both President Donald Trump and his Democratic opponent Joe Biden tweeted about the GDP report today. The president tweeted, "GDP number just announced, biggest and best in the history of our country and not even close. Next year will be fantastic. However, sleepy Joe Biden and his proposed record-setting tax increase would kill it all. So glad this great GDP number came out before November 3rd. And from Joe Biden, "GDP rose last quarter, but visits to food banks haven't slowed and poverty has grown. We're on track for the worst economic downturn in over 70 years, and Donald Trump is on track to be the first president since Herbert Hoover to leave office with less jobs than when he came in." Now, both candidates are in Florida today. President Trump held a rally in Tampa, and he was joined on the campaign trail for the first time by First Lady Melania Trump.
"For those of you who are still deciding who to vote for on Tuesday, I hope that what I have to say will prove to you that a vote for President Trump is a vote for a better America." In a time when hate, negativity, and fear are the messages the media streams into our homes, and the large tech companies are protecting political censorship, we need to remember what is really important. My husband's administration is focused on the future. The health and safety of the American people, the education and well-being of our children, the safety and security of our streets and communities, and the protection of our fundamental family values. Under Donald's leadership, we have blocked out the noise and focused on you, the American people.
And after the First Lady's opening remarks in Tampa, the president took the stage.
"On November 3rd, we must finish the job and drain the rest of the swamp. We've done a lot of it. From Pensacola to Miami, from Orlando to Jacksonville, and from Tallahassee to right here in Tampa, we inherit the legacy of We inherit the incredible legacy of Florida patriots who gave their blood, sweat, and tears for this beloved nation. We stand on the shoulders of American heroes who crossed the oceans, blazed the trails, settled the continent, tamed the wilderness, laid down the railroads, dug out the Panama Canal, raised up the great skyscrapers, won two world wars, defeated fascism and communism, and from right here in this beautiful state, landed our brave American astronauts on the face of the moon. You've done a lot. We made America into the single greatest nation in the history of the world, and the best is yet to come. Proud citizens like you helped build this country, and together we are taking back our country. We are returning power to you, the American people. With your help, your devotion, and your drive, we are going to keep on working. We are going to keep on fighting. And we are going to keep on winning, winning, winning. We're winning. We are winning again. We are winning again. We are one movement, one people, one family, and one glorious nation under God. And together with the incredible people of Florida, we have made America powerful again. We have made America wealthy again. We have made America strong again. We have made America proud again. We have made America safe again. And we will make America great again. Thank you, Florida. Get out and vote. Thank you.
And that was President Trump in Tampa today. He had planned a North Carolina rally tonight, but that has been delayed until Monday due to weather. Now, Joe Biden also held a rally in Tampa, but he started off his day in Coconut Creek, Florida.
5 days left, folks. Millions of Americans are already voting. Millions more are going to vote by the end of this week. And I believe when you use your power, the power to vote, you're going to change the course of this country for generations to come at home and abroad. This election is the most important one you've ever voted in, whether it's your first or 10th. Ladies and gentlemen, the heart and soul of this country is at stake right here in Florida. It's up to you. You hold the key. If Florida goes blue, it's over. It's over. Look. Press has heard me say this a long time. Wall Street and CEOs didn't build this country. People standing out here in their automobiles, you're the ones that built this country. The middle class built this country. And unions built the middle class. You're the ones who are going to save the country now that you build it. In these final days, keep that sense of empowerment with you, that sense of optimism, of what we can do, what we will overcome. I've never been more optimistic about America or the American people than I am today. And on November the 3rd, we're going to unite this country and show the world who we really are. I know it's hard. Over these past few months, there's been so much pain, so much suffering, so much loss. Over 225,000 dead Americans because of the negligence and the consequence of COVID. More than 16,000 here in Florida alone. As I said in April, Carl Anthony lost his mom. Millions of people out there are out of work, on the edge, can't see the light at the end of the tunnel, and Donald Trump has given up.
And that was Joe Biden at a drive-in rally earlier today in Coconut Creek, Florida. Now, more on the election in a minute with former House Speaker Newt Gingrich and former Attorney General Eric Holder. This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. And welcome back to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. Here's a few more headlines. The Trump administration has released rules for COVID vaccines, which propose free shots for seniors, Medicaid recipients, and those with private insurance. Boeing is cutting about 11,000 jobs due to the pandemic and the grounding of the 737 MAX. French President Emmanuel Macron says he will send 7,000 troops to protect schools and religious sites after a knife attack inside a church in Nice left three people dead. And Florida entrepreneur David Correa is the first defendant to plead guilty in a campaign finance and business fraud case involving associates of Rudy Giuliani, the former New York City mayor and attorney for President Trump. Now back to the campaign. Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich is predicting that President Trump will win Georgia in next week's election, saying the polls showing a close race are wrong. The current Real Clear Politics polling average shows the president and Democrat Joe Biden in a dead heat, with each receiving about 47%. Speaker Gingrich represented Georgia's 6th congressional district for 20 years as a Republican, and he was interviewed today by Washington Post national political reporter Robert Costa.
A few years ago, we weren't talking about Georgia as a battleground, the state you represented in Congress for years. Now it is a battleground. Are you worried about President Trump's chances in that state?
Well, I'm not worried about him. I think he'll carry the state, but it's certainly more of a fight than it would have been a few years ago. And I think you have to give Stacey Abrams and others some credit for how much they've gone out and they've organized and they have gotten people registered, which is what America should be all about. I think in the end, President Trump will carry Georgia. And I suspect in the end, we'll have both U.S. Senate seats, but it's certainly more of a fight than it would have been, say, 12 years ago.
How have those suburbs around Atlanta changed over the past 20 years?
Well, I think they're more diverse ethnically. I think they're probably a little bit more moderate on social policy than they would have been. And I think that the Democrats have been very effective in organizing in suburban areas, not just in Georgia, but around the country. It's one of their great strengths. On the other hand, the Republicans are enormously well organized when you get beyond into the exurbs and the small towns and the rural counties. And the margins that are going to roll up in those areas is pretty enormous. And you can't quite tell how the votes will work. Stacey Abrams lost the governorship in part because she lost a significant number of African-American males in rural Georgia who found her to be too much of a big city person, too anti-gun, and too dismissive of agriculture. So actually the margin, a large part of the margin by which the Republican governor was elected came from African-American males who just repudiated the Democratic nominee.
And that was former House Speaker Newt Gingrich. He went on to predict that President Trump will win re-election with about 326 electoral votes. Also joining Washington Post reporter Robert Costa today was Eric Holder, former attorney general under President Obama. They talked about efforts to discourage some people from voting.
So you're tracking voter suppression and redistricting efforts across the country, but let's start with voter suppression. What are you paying attention to 5 days to go?
You know, the concerns I have about the long lines, which I think reflect, overwhelming enthusiasm by the American people. But I also note that studies have shown if you're an African-American, you're 7 times more likely to have to wait in line over 1 hour than your white counterpart. And so I'm concerned about that. I'm concerned about the measures that are being taken by the Republican Party to keep people away from the polls. And now they're going so far as to say that they don't want to count all the votes that have been cast. There have been lawsuits or moves in Texas by Republicans to somehow take those votes that have already been cast by people who drove up in their cars and not count those votes. It really strikes me. You know, this is something that is, I think, a major differentiator between the parties. Democrats want as many people to vote as is possible, want all the votes to be counted. Republicans want to restrict the number of people who can vote, and then apparently don't want to count all the votes. That is inconsistent with who we say we are as an American democracy.
We remember 10 years ago covering this at the Post, the Republicans sweeping across not only congressional races, but state houses. Are Democrats going to do better this time around in winning state seats and state legislative seats?
It's a good question. And I think, yeah, Democrats are going to do a lot better. I think, quite frankly, Democrats didn't focus on those state legislative races to the extent that we should have in 2010. As a result, the 2011 redistricting went well for the Republicans and led to the gerrymandering that we have seen and that has affected our politics over the course of this last decade. I think Democrats are focusing now on state-level races. It's certainly something that I've been doing going around the country, telling people, look, I get it. This is an existential presidential election, but you've got to focus on these down-ballot races, that these state legislative races will probably have a greater impact on your life on a day-to-day basis, because these are the places where decisions are made on women's reproductive rights. Criminal justice reform will undoubtedly come from the states. A lot of health care decisions will come from the states. Right. There's a whole variety of things that come from the states as opposed to the federal government.
And former Attorney General Eric Holder is chairman of the National Democratic Redistricting Committee. Now, in another event today in Washington, the Bipartisan Policy Center held a discussion entitled, What to Expect When You're Expecting an Unprecedented Election. One of the panelists was Edgardo Cortez with the Brennan Center for Justice and a former Virginia Commissioner on Elections. He gave advice on how Americans should watch election night results as they come in.
Well, I think on election night, I think the first key for everybody, and I know it's going to be hard, is patience. I mean, Chris talked about, you know, kind of how they're hoping to push out at least the first batch of results fairly early on in the evening. But the process of counting ballots and reporting them out takes a while. Not just in a pandemic situation, but it just takes some time. I think in terms of trusted sources of information, you have obviously the state and local election websites that are pushing out information about results, and they're doing that pretty frequently throughout the night as results are being updated and tallies are completed at the polling places and reported up. You also have kind of as a backup, you have entities like the Associated Press, which also has, they have a program where they have people stationed at local election offices and polling places around the country where there are expected to be close races, so they can also collect results there at the point where they're reported and publicly posted. And so there are a lot of different ways to receive that information. The one thing I would caution people again is that election results that get posted on election night are unofficial. The process of both counting the ballots and of confirming those counts keeps going after the election. And election officials have a lot of processes that they go through to make sure that not only have they counted all the ballots that are that can be counted, but that those reports are accurate. They go back and they double check everything that's done in the polling places. They go back and double check what's done at the county level. We hopefully will have a number of states this year doing audits of the election results after the election. So there's a lot of steps in that process till we get to the final results of the election.
And Edgardo Cortez is an election security advisor with the Brennan Center for Justice and a former Virginia Commissioner of Elections. And that event with the Bipartisan Policy Center is available to watch or listen to in its entirety at cspan.org. And finally, in England, the Guardian newspaper reports, quote, Labour has suspended its former leader Jeremy Corbyn after he said anti-Semitism in the party was overstated following a damning report from the Equality Watchdog. The move is likely to ignite a civil war in the Labour Party. Corbyn condemned his suspension as a political intervention and said he would strongly contest the action. Mr. Corbyn gave an interview then to the Guardian newspaper.
What I said today was that anti-Semitism is unacceptable in any form. What I said was
you told me it was exaggerated.
I said the number.
It was dramatically overstated.
What I said was the numbers of cases in the public perception had become overstated. The existence of the problem I fully acknowledge, which is why I took action to end the problem in the party by introducing a process to get anti-Semites out of the party. No, I'm not part of the problem. The problem is anti-Semitism historically, anti-Semitism in the present, and the fear that many people have of being under attack at their synagogue, or indeed mosques, temples, and lots of other places within our society. We need to tackle racism in every conceivable form within our society.
And that's former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn. The Guardian story goes on to say that, quote, the Equality and Human Rights Commission report found Labour responsible for unlawful acts of harassment and discrimination over anti-Semitism. It cites serious failings in the Labour Party leadership in addressing anti-Semitism and an inadequate process for handling anti-Semitism complaints. Well, thank you for joining us on Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. You can get this program and other C-SPAN programs as podcasts wherever you get your podcasts or at cspan.org. And get the free C-SPAN Radio app to listen on the go. Have a good evening. We'll see you tomorrow with another Washington Today live at 5 p.m. Eastern Time.